Welcome to The Winsome Creationist, where we explore God's world using a model-building approach, interact with a gracious tone, and take a firm stand on the literal truth of creation found in God's Word. Join host Steve Schramm and occasional guests as they explore the mysteries and majesties from creation to the flood, Babel to the cross, and everywhere in between. And now, here's your host.
Welcome into another episode of The Winsome Creationist. I'm joined again by my friend, Dr. Phil Dennis. And this time around, what we'd like to do, if you've watched the past couple videos in our series, we've been talking through one of the most common answers and responses to the distant starlight problem, as it's well known, for young age creationists. And so we have galaxies and planets and stars that are a long way away. And there's issues with that, reconciling that with the idea of a 6 to 10, roughly 1,000-year-old universe. And so how do we get the light from the stars to the Earth? That's sort of the central question. And so we've talked a little bit about Jason Lyle's anisotropic synchrony convention. We've talked about sort of a proposed enhancement on the ASC model called the CTC model with creation time coordinates. And we're eventually going to get to Phil's model in this series, which is a general relativity-based model as opposed to special relativity. But before we get there, we had some comments and some questions come in on the past two episodes, and we wanted to take some time to look at some of those and kind of hopefully dispel some misunderstandings and provide some further clarification where needed. So I'm excited to do this, Phil, and excited to have you here. And so here's what we're going to do. We're going to start by kind of going into the idea of conventionality. That's where we're going to start. There's a lot of confusion, it seems, around whether or not you can just change some coordinates and that has an objective difference on the reality of the distance between two objects. And so I think that's where we want to start, Phil. So I'll let you take it away whenever you're ready, sir.
Okay. Yes. Thank you, Steve. One of the common supports, or what they think is a logical support for the ASC, is the conventionality of units of measurement. And they want to say that ASC is like units of measurement. I don't believe that analogy holds any water. And what I'm going to illustrate here is the distinction between what we will call a standard and conventional units. The main point I'm going to make is that once you've established a standard, you don't change the standard. You can label the standard with different units of measurement, but by comparing different weights with the standard, you can determine the arithmetic to compute, for example, kilograms to pounds, right? So for example, say we have a standard weight. And the thing I want to point out is when you establish a standard weight, you're not required to use one of this size. You could use any size, right? So that's the conventionality of that. But once you've established that as a standard, as the unit of measure or whatever you want to say, you don't change the standard. And so to the right here, I show that if this were a 1 kilogram weight, you can label it as 1 kilogram, but we know 1 kilogram is the same as 2.2 pounds. And if the conventionality support that the ASC advocates like to appeal to were true, well, you're not changing anything, right? This is one kilogram and I change units and it's 2.2 pounds. So by changing units, you're not changing anything. So the point is, I have the same underlying objective reality and no change in weight. Now, somebody could say, well, let's just say this is no longer 1 kilogram. Let's say it's 2 kilograms. Well, you've just relabeled the standard by another unit, right?
Right.
That wouldn't, once you've established it as a standard and claims it's 1 kilogram, you better not cross it off and put two kilograms on it, right?
Right.
So you can't change units, right? So that would be a bogus argument. So that's the whole point. The conventionality of units does not support the ASC thesis.
And so to apply this to, you know, to the Starlight issue in particular, you know, this, correct me if I'm wrong, or what I'm really asking is for you to clarify this. You know, you're referring to the fact that, okay, well, we can choose, says Dr. Lyle, between the Einstein synchrony convention and the anisotropic synchrony convention. We can choose because he says that there's no way to objectively determine the one-way speed of light. And so we actually know from our previous discussions that there actually does seem to be ways to objectively determine the one-way speed of light, but he's saying that there's not. And if there's not, then we just get to choose which synchrony convention we use. And God chose, apparently, the anisotropic synchrony convention, and that's how we can have the light from the stars on the Earth by day four. Is that basically the point that they're trying to make?
Yeah, that's pretty much the case. But like you said, we can measure the one-way speed of light. And the ASC actually, as I pointed out, goes back to Reichenbach. And it was based on the technology that you had to use a two-way speed of light because of the other notion that you cannot synchronize remote clocks, which we'll get into a little bit later. So you basically had to have a stationary single clock, send a light beam out, have it reflect from an object, comes back. And the only clock measurement that they claim is reliable, I guess, is the single clock you have at the origin. And so all you can measure is a round trip speed of light, and therefore you don't know when it reflected. So as a matter of fact, that's always been a pretty interesting thing. If they say you don't know when it reflected from the mirror, which means there really was no event when it reflected from the mirror. I think I made that point in one of the other talks, right? So, I mean, are you going to deny that there was an actual event at which the photon bounced off the mirror and came back? But he's essentially saying that, or Reichenbach, that you don't know, so you can say that the reading on the clock when it reflected was any time between the time you sent the light out and the time you received it.
Right. And I seem to remember one comment being that Lyle, and maybe this is wrong, I'm not sure, but I think one commenter made the point that Lyle didn't appeal to Reichenbach at any point. And I think your point is not necessarily that Lyle appealed to Reichenbach. I think your point was just kind of the objective fact that that the ASC thinking and the inability to measure the one-way speed of light goes back to, you know, the science that was available when he was working on it. Right. And the point is that things have changed.
Right. Yeah, that is a major point. But the fact that Lyle, I don't know who said he didn't appeal to Reichenbach, that would be a scholarly omission in my view. I think maybe he did. Okay. But I mean, that's where it comes from. I mean, the very notation, the epsilon notation, the Reichenbach conventionality thesis. Yeah, it goes back to Reichenbach. So, okay, maybe we should go on to the, I'm trying to make some examples here of conventionality. Yes. And this is just another example. You know, for example, the famous quote, a rose by any other name would smell as sweet. So in different languages, and of course, languages are a convention within a group of people, correct? Right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure.
So,
yeah.
So in English, this is a rose, it's a rosa in Spanish, and all these different spellings, and I'm not going to attempt to pronounce them.
The Arabic one is quite interesting.
Yeah, that's right. It doesn't have that R sound, Artafe or whatever, right? But, that's why we have dictionaries, right? The dictionary is the method of translating between the different conventions. And in mathematics, with coordinate systems, you have the exact same issue. Right, which is an interesting point that perhaps I haven't emphasized. You have to know, and I think maybe I did mention this, because I said in order to implement ASC, you have to know what the one-way speed of light is. Right, all the formulas for ASC incorporate one-way speed of light. So, in other words, to make the speed of light infinite, you have to know how to set your clocks according to the one-way speed of light.
Right, right. Okay. Which is puzzling if we can't, you know, if it's impossible
right.
to measure.
Right. 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 So the mathematics establishes the methodology for how to translate from ESC to ASC. Now, how do we know how to translate from one language to another? Because we're referring to an objective reality.
Right?
The rose is the standard. So we have huge to compare point. All the we have to compare all the coordinate systems to the objective reality. Now I'm going to digress a little bit here and get a little historical/technical commentary. When Gauss and Riemann, who are the two famous developers of what is known as differential geometry, were studying things such as, well, it was Gauss, how to measure distances on the Earth, surface of the Earth, geodesy. The surface of the Earth is curved, so you can't use Euclidean geometry. So his concern was, how do you measure absolute distances independently of coordinates? And that's how he came up with differential geometry. And that's the basis of how you determine the properties of a geometric space independent of coordinates. That was his issue, right? Because the distance from London, say, to Liverpool is independent of what map projection you use.
Right.
Right. So, okay. So let me go ahead and go to this little bit more abstract representation. Hopefully what I mentioned about roses and dictionary, this is basically the same concept, except Minkowski space, upon which Lyle bases his ASC, is analogous to the rose. Maybe that's the best way to put it. And okay. And then I can represent the properties of Minkowski space in either ESC coordinates. And this arrow intends to make the point or represent that for a given point in Minkowski space, I can assign some numbers to it.
Right? Okay. Got it.
And
yeah.
I should have drawn it coming from the same point. So coming from the same point, I'm going to get different numbers, but number one is the same point, right? Which is, this corresponds to the rows. So there's an infinitude of coordinate systems that you can use to describe the geometry of Minkowski space, just as there's an infinitude of coordinate systems for the Earth, to represent the Earth. For example, Mercator coordinates, polar stereographic coordinates. There's, I think I mentioned this in some talks, just go pull out your Rand McNally Atlas or whatever and look at the various, you know, when you're looking at the Antarctica, right, it's you got a different projection, right? But to summarize, each of these coordinate systems are conventional, all right? Just like the languages are conventional. So these correspond to different languages, but these different languages that describe the space, you're not altering the space in any way.
Right.
Now, Lyle makes a gaffe. I'm just going to be blunt and say that in his The Physics of Einstein, says that somehow ESC coordinates enforce symmetry on Minkowski space. Well, no, ESC coordinates do not enforce any symmetries on Minkowski space, in the same way that Mercator coordinates do not enforce certain symmetries, or polar stereographic enforces any symmetries. Those different projections are used just to highlight certain aspects of the geometry, right? Different projections, as we know, for example, Mercator projection, things that are further away from the equator get distorted. You know, Greenland looks gigantic, you know, the North Pole gets stretched out into a line and so on and so forth, right? So those distortions don't represent the symmetries of the Earth. So Einstein's synchrony convention coordinates do not enforce any symmetries, but they merely express the symmetries that are already there. Mm. And they are, in fact, the natural coordinates, and the speed of light is isotropic. And I want to point out, Minkowski space is isotropic speed of light. So ASC, unfortunately, obscures the symmetries, and of course, it cannot alter them because the symmetries are invariant. They're a property of Minkowski space, irrespective of what coordinate system you use, which was exactly the problem that Gauss solved mathematically, which is now known as the discipline or the subject called differential geometry.
Right. Now, so what's before we move on to the, you know, to your technical note there, one sort of clarifying question. So one of the reasons this came up is because, you know, one of the commenters had a question about or an observation that we thought that we were saying that the speed of light would need to be necessarily isotropic in Minkowski space. But they said something to the effect of, well, it doesn't seem necessary to me, but that's actually a requirement that Minkowski space has an assumption of isotropic light speed. And you said, well, no, that's wrong. You actually can't have isotropic or anisotropic speed of light in Minkowski space pretty much by definition. And so as a layperson, the puzzling thing to me, and I'll let you expand on that, but the puzzling thing to me is, well, this model uses Minkowski space and it's literally called the anisotropic synchrony convention. Help me. Right. Help me understand.
Right. Well, that's what I've tried to do here is that isotropic speed of light is a property of Minkowski space. It's a geometric property of Minkowski space, and you can't alter it by changing coordinates.
Right. So you cannot have an
anisotropic speed of light Minkowski space because essentially by definition, Minkowski space has anisotropy. Right. So that's a logical contradiction. Now, I'll just chalk it up to the commentator asking the question doesn't understand what Minkowski space is.
Right.
So,
yeah. Right. And so this sort of provides a little bit more definition around, and you know, we can't go into all of, oh, well, what's the actual definition of Minkowski space, but that's something you could look up on your own. And, you know,
I guess another analogy I would make, sorry, I'm speaking over you. Another analogy you could make is flatness a property of Euclidean space. Can I make Euclidean space spherical via a coordinate system? No, you can't.
No, right. So, right,
yeah,
no.
Right. The Euclidean plane that we studied in high school geometry is flat. And you can't, later on when you learn analytic geometry and start throwing Cartesian coordinates on it, you can't turn that Euclidean plane into a hyperbolic or a sphere or anything else. So a spherical Euclidean space is a oxymoron.
Got it.
Okay.
Very good.
So here's a technical note, and those that want to at least delve into it or are thinking about going into mathematics or a creationist that wants to go into cosmology, a lot of this stuff comes out of the differential geometry developed by Gauss and later Riemann. Given a space in some sort of coordinate system, the question is, how do you determine the symmetries? Well, there's a set of there's a mathematical technique or method that you can discover the symmetries of a space irrespective of the coordinates. It's called the Killing equations, and that produces what's known as a Killing vector field. And here's the link that your readers can go to check that out. But I'll just give a quick summary here. I won't read the whole thing, but the highlighted section is that the Killing vector field generates the symmetry. Now, generate doesn't mean it creates it. It means mathematically speaking, it's like solving an equation. All right. So I solve the equation and that equation generates or shows you how to determine the symmetries. And the main point is the Killing vector will not distort distances on the object. Right. So I can go to ASC coordinates, compute the generators. And lo and behold, the generators are precisely the transformations of special relativity, which are known as rotation, translation, and boost. In other words, transforming from one inertial frame to another, you know, from velocity zero to velocity v. All right. So that's called the Lorentz Poincaré transformation group. So, right. So that's standard stuff. So let's see, what else do we have here? yeah, this is just another, I'm going to leave it up for those that have the mathematical savvy to be able to decipher what I'm saying here. But what I've drawn here is a line segment PQ, say in the Euclidean plane. And rather than using your standard Cartesian coordinates, you know, lines X, Y at right angles that we learned in analytic geometry, I basically distorted the coordinate system into a new coordinate system that measures V along these lines and measures U along these lines. They're just labels. They're not distances. So by using this new coordinate mesh, I didn't change the length C of this Euclidean line segment that goes from P to Q. Okay. Mm. There's a lot of technicalities that I could go through, but DS squared here, which is a differential geometry term, gives you the distance between P and Q if you do the appropriate mathematics. But you see, the distance depends not just on U and V, these DUs and DVs. It depends upon these new quantities, this G mu mu, G mu, G UV, and G VV. And there's a technique for calculating those when you transform the coordinates. And you have to use this instead of X squared plus Y squared if you were using Euclidean coordinates. So anyway, the main point I'm trying to make here is you don't alter the length of geometric objects by changing coordinates. And that goes back to what I said on the previous slide. You cannot change the speed of light by altering coordinates. Okay, so that's
yes.
Okay. So I'm just going to say it. This is a little bit more detailed, less busy than the previous one, but it's showing what I mentioned, that if I have the distance DS between, say, A and B, and perhaps I should have left it as P and Q, that I just measure DX as a distance, DY as a distance, and use the Pythagorean theorem, right? The hypotenuse is the square root of the sum of the squares of the opposite sides for a right triangle. But if I just say, let's make some new weird coordinates, U and V, which, by the way, are no longer distance, right? Because if I take the square root of a distance, I don't have a distance, right? If something's 4 feet away and I take the square root, so I get 2 square root of feet for U, right?
Yeah.
To use the units. And I get, if this is 5, I get the square root of 5 square root of feet for V. You have to use a new formula here, right? But DS is going to be the same number. So the point again, coordinates are conventions, cannot alter distances which are not conventional. Change of coordinates cannot alter the invariant, the objective reality of DS. And
yeah, and I know there's probably some asking, how many different ways can you say this? And I think the point is, I don't know that there isn't enough different ways you can say it, because this is the biggest issue that there is.
Really. Oh, exactly. This is what everybody's stuck on. And they give lip service to it, that you can't change distances because it's a convention. And I think I mentioned to you previously that if you agree that, going back to my slide on 1 pound and, I'm sorry, 1 kilogram and 2.2 pounds, I can't change the weight via convention. So how can changing coordinates change the speed of light?
Exactly.
Right. Yes. Right. Yep. So that shoots the whole argument in the foot. In other words, when they appeal to conventionality of units, they think that support for ASC, it actually is a defeater of ASC in my mind, if you think through all the issues.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Very good.
Let's see. This is an interesting aspect. So the question is, do we expect distances to change if we change coordinates? Well, I've beat the drum how many times now? The answer is no, right? And I believe one of your commentators, person making a comment, said something that we expect the distance to change if we change coordinates. Is that correct? Am I quoting him properly? Do you have that at your fingertips there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do. He made the point that that he thought that if you're working with Minkowski distance and you're pointing out that the result is different between isotropic and anisotropic models, he says, yes, that's expected because different coordinates will give different values.
Okay, and we just beat the drum and said, no, that's not true. What I was referring to was not that we get different distances, whether using, what he said, Minkowski distances. Well, that's the only distances we can use, right? You measure distances in a Minkowski space using the Minkowski distance formula. But the point I was making that caused the change in distances was in the Reichenbach convention, and here we have the case where he could claim that the reflection time was T prime rather than T, according to ESC. So this is the ESC reflection time. This is the ESC reflection time in Minkowski space. The point I was making was that the distance T to R is not the same as the distance T prime to R. Well, that's not the same thing as changing the coordinates of this point T and this point R. We're talking about two different line segments. Well, the fact that two different line segments have two different lengths is rather unremarkable, right? So we agree.
He clarified on that there were some times where it appears that you calculated, because this slide is from another talk, an isotropic C value for calculations that were supposed to be in an anisotropic frame. He was referring to what you were doing with these triangle diagrams.
Right. Yes. But to clarify that even, I'm allowed to use the isotropic C if I'm using ESC. That would be one way of putting it, right? And of course, to beat the drum again, that's the true speed of light, right? The ESC speed of light, right? So I'm allowed to do that because if you want to say the, as long as I'm consistent, right? If I use ESC coordinates and use C, that's the appropriate value to be using for ESC, right? The question is, can you use a deny C in ASC? Okay. And to summarize here again, that was the whole point of Reichenbach. The question is, which are the simultaneous events? Is it this event along this clock that's simultaneous with reflection, or this point that's simultaneous with the reflection? Well, according to Reichenbach, since you don't know, and I've already mentioned this, that means there was no time or reflection. It was all of them. Well, that's eternalism.
Right.
Okay. So if I stick in the ESC coordinate system, he's saying, well, I don't know where it reflected from. So I'm free to say it reflected that this T prime and the R reflection is actually simultaneous in a real present. Or is it T and R that when it reflected, it is in a real present? Well, the whole notion of this is eternalist. There is no objective point of when it reflected. So, in other words, they're using an argument from ignorance, basically, is the way to put it, I guess.
Yes.
Okay, let's go back into a historical context. Back when GR was formulated by Einstein, Painleave, who I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly, had a discussion with Einstein. And that discussion, and I guess I can forgive Painleave at the time because it was just formulated and people were grappling with the issues, right? And not everybody was up to speed. But at the time, it's clear that Painleave's grasp for relativistic physics was deficient. Nonetheless, apparently Painleave placed stress on mere coordinates. Here's what Painleave had said. This is a translation from the French. It is pure imagination to claim to draw consequences of this nature from ds squared. Well, as we've just talked about, ds squared is the reality. But he's saying basically that it's imaginary to draw consequences from ds squared. And Einstein wrote back to Painleave and correctly pointed out that ds is in fact the objective content, not the coordinate. So I'm beating the drum again in historical context, but this is Albert Einstein. And of course, Lyell's book is The Physics of Einstein. And I'm going to point out Lyell agrees with Einstein, as do I, in all differential geometry students and so on and so forth. So Einstein wrote back to Painleave, only conclusions reached, and I emphasize this, after the elimination of coordinates. There you have it in a nutshell. So if we're talking about ASC or ESC, what I've endeavored to do in some of my discussions is point out how to eliminate coordinates or if you're using coordinates to identify which coordinates are the invariant DS coordinates, if you're following what I'm saying. Can I verify that in ASC coordinates that DX is in fact a coordinate independent distance? In other words, it's not the coordinates that's defining the distance. I take the distance and I decide to label it DX, if you're following what I'm saying. It's which way do you put the cart or the horse? It's back to the standard. It's the length that is the standard, and I'm going to label that length DS. Okay. So we have to eliminate coordinates. So it doesn't depend upon ASC. It really doesn't depend upon ESC. So only conclusions reached after the elimination of coordinates may pretend to an objective significance. The metrical interpretation of the quantity DS squared is not pure imagination, but the deep core of the theory itself. And here's
that's
a link.
That's important.
Yes.
That's so, really important.
Yes, right. So Einstein clearly understood what Gauss was saying, what Riemann was saying, and all other mathematicians were saying. Okay, so as I said, Lyell agrees with Einstein. So do I. So this is a quote from The Physics of Einstein. And this gets back to the issue where I was pointing out earlier, you can't change the distance as long as we're talking about the same two events that anchor the endpoint of a line, you know, the PQ.
Of course, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we can't talk about PQ then some other interval, AB, and claim, well, look, they're different lengths. Well, they're different intervals. Right. So here's what Lyell says. So Michael and Sarah, these are two imaginary participants, may disagree on the times and positions of any events in the universe, which are just coordinates, by the way. But they, right. Emphasis added, but they will always agree on the space-time interval between any two events. If I choose two different events, right, I'm going to get different distances. But we're talking about the same two events. And then Lyell says, this tells us something quite profound about the universe. The space-time interval is the real absolute quantity. Okay. Well, the speed of light in ASC doesn't use any real absolute quantities. It uses coordinates, right? And Einstein said, you got to eliminate coordinates, right? Lyell failed to eliminate coordinates. He's a matter of fact, he's totally, beholden to coordinates, and so was Reichenbach to get the program going. And here's the page.
To be clear here, I mean, and again, we're not trying to be like, you know, mean or put down. That's not what this is about at all. After all, this is the Winsome Creationist podcast. But the point we're trying to make, I mean, there's really no other way to say it, that this is just a logical contradiction, right? I mean, this is just Lyell contradicting himself.
Right. Yeah. He hasn't thought through. Yeah, I would say so. He hasn't thought through all the issues. And
okay. Right.
So, but he does say this, which I find interesting later on page, the very next page, relativity does have absolutes, such as the speed of light in vacuum. Now, I suppose ASC advocates and even Lyell could say, well, what I meant by speed of light in vacuum was the two-way speed of light, but he didn't say that there, right?
Right. Yeah.
So, and the space-time interval. Well, see, I'm claiming the space-time interval is a property of Minkowski space. So I'm beating the drum yet again, right? That,
yeah.
And these are invariant absolute quantities, right? Okay. But Einstein said correctly, one must eliminate coordinates to arrive at physical conclusions. I agree. And as I said, Lyell failed to do so. And that's what I've tried to point out in one of the previous talks was, you know, the distance changed its meaning when you went to ASC. It was no longer, it was a coordinate that changed its physical geometric meaning. It was no longer the distance to the reflector.
Exactly.
Right. Providing that you're a presentist, but unfortunately, Lyell has an eternalist point of view, which I hope someday he will discard.
Amen.
Okay.
All right. Let's move through. We've got probably about, I don't know, 10-ish more minutes. So if we want to try to kind of speed through some of these last ones, we can, or we can take our time.
I think we can.
Okay.
some people keep asking, can we keep distance clocks and synchronization? Well, the answer is yes. And this actually, because otherwise GPS would not work, period. And I'll show that in a later slide. And the second point is that the notion that among some that clocks cannot be synchronized would invalidate all of relativity. Mm. For example, everybody talks about time dilation, right? So yeah. if a moving clock, T prime, runs slow by this reduced factor relative to a stationary clock, then that depends upon the invariant interval. Then we know how to transform or compute and correct one clock that's moving, right? So all we have to do is, if I have a moving clock relative to another one and I want to know what the stationary clock reading is, I just divide by that factor, right? So I've got that diagram over here. So I have a moving clock that moves from O to B. It measures this invariant length, T prime, which Lyle agrees with. So, if this is the time clicked on the stationary clock, then T is the length of OA, which is an invariant, and T prime is the length of OB, which is an invariant. So we can synchronize them. So if the speed of light depends upon synchronization, then GPS wouldn't work, right? For example, I guess I got these out of order. Here's the technical details of how GPS works. And everybody uses, I think, GPS every day on their smartphones, right? Mm-hmm. Your navigator, your car navigator, how many more miles do you have to go, and so on and so forth. So it basically needs to know the speed of light C, because it's a one-way phenomenon, right? The satellites are transmitting their GPS signals to this ground station located at X0, Y0. And we need to solve to find, if I have three satellites, say, the common point of intersection. So I don't know what X0, Y0 is, but the satellites know where they are, and they tell us when they transmitted. And based upon time of reception, we can compute the radii of these circles. And so that's what's going on in your cell phone. So I won't go through all the details. Interestingly enough, you don't have to have your ground clock synchronized, which is very interesting. You could reset your cell phone's time wrongly, I guess, and not have it update, and you'll still get your right position. There's a technique for doing that. It's known as time difference of arrival. So you take these differences between the, and you don't need to know what your time is. You basically solve for it based upon the speed of light. So, and here's an example. Say, according to ASC, we can make the speed of light any value we want, from 1/2 the speed of light to infinite. So I've enlarged it. So if the speed of light were larger, this would be a larger circle, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so would this one. D1, D2, and D3 would be larger radii. And you notice what happens. You're here and they don't intersect, so you don't know where you are. So I adduced this as another example why ASC is wrong. And the only answer is that because their C is not the real speed of light.
Right, exactly.
All right. And here's another example. I'll try to get through these real quick. How about the New Horizons mission? This relates back to, can we compute synchronization? If you use the time dilation formula, which Lyle agrees with, the calculation of the time dilation over the entire flight to Pluto was only about 0.5 seconds. So the New Horizons had an atomic clock on it, or at least it was atomic. It was a very highly stable clock. It had an accuracy of, you know, over years, many years, you know, it ticks accurately. And it was set, its clock was set to zero when they launched it, and it clicks and keeps track of seconds, which is called mission elapsed time. And so we can compute the time of transmission, the New Horizon clock, to the time of receipt on Earth. And I want to emphasize this again, time dilation only changed it. So we might have even if I didn't correct the New Horizons clock by subtracting off or adding on 0.5 seconds, 0.5 seconds relative to 4.5 hours is nothing to talk about, right?
Sure, so of course, yeah.
So we know it takes 4.5 hours for the telemetry to download from the New Horizons from Pluto to the Earth. Right.
Huh. I mean,
the clocks were essentially in sync up to within a half a second.
Yeah.
Right. So, yeah, it took, what, 9.5 years for a probe to get to Pluto, and over 9.5 years at its speed. That's the only time error. I'm not going to worry about a half second. Well, I mean, they can say, well, see, you couldn't synchronize it. It was a half second off. Well, I don't care. Right. If you believe time dilation. Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. This is, I'm beating the horse yet again. Can there be an anisotropic Minkowski space? Again, I've said over and over again, the intrinsic geometric property of Minkowski space at the speed of light is isotropic. And I've already said this. It's like asking, can I have a spherical Euclidean space? That's an oxymoron. And remember, the objective space-time interval ds in Minkowski space is this, where dx, dy, and dz are actually independent of coordinates, even though it is a coordinate label. It's the distance. And this interval is independent of coordinates. And so if I set dt equals 0, I get Euclidean space, right? And I think I mentioned the fact that if you take ASC synchrony as the space of simultaneity, then you no longer have a Euclidean space, which means Euclidean geometry wouldn't work here. So, all right. Mm. So some people seem to take issue with the fact that, calling Lyell an eternalist. I think he's just hasn't thought it through. I don't think. He probably is, if you think, is that he would remain one if he thought it through. But this shows the this is a quote, and more people should actually grab his book and read it if they're ASC advocates to see what Lyell himself says. I'll just read the emphasized text here. He says, nonetheless, hypothetically, if faster than light travel were possible, then time travel into where the past would also be possible, right?
Right. Yeah.
Well, that's back to what I said in one of the previous talks, that time is not a place. The past does not exist. So how can you travel to a place that does not exist? If you believe the past exists, then you're an eternalist. Right.
Exactly. Yeah.
And time travel is impossible in present. So this is Lyell himself. And in presentism, which we may have a session on, the philosophy of eternalism and presentism. Time is real and the past does not exist. Okay, let's see. We're almost done. I think I got one more slide.
Yeah, one more.
A couple of other good questions were asked. So this is a good paraphrase of the questions of one of the commentators. The question is, star displacement an issue, and what about time dilation? My claim is that star displacement, which is essentially stars that find themselves at great distance out of galaxies at distances that would imply they're traveling greater than the speed of light. This is not an issue, because according to general relativity, and this gets into the issue that you mentioned, do we use special relativistic or general relativistic models? And we need to use general relativity, because at large scales of the universe, the predominant force at large scales is gravity, right? So it's the galaxies are attracting each other due to gravitational attraction. But according to general relativity, matter can actually travel faster than the special relativistic speed of light, c. And I've made the point many times that the governing theory is general relativity, not special relativity. Special relativity is a special case. General relativity is the general case. So special relativity doesn't dictate over or rule over general relativity. It's the other way around. Okay. So, and according to general relativity, galaxies can reach, according to the extrapolation of the Big Bang solution, 41 gigalight years in 14 billion years. Well, you can see that that's 3 times the speed of light. Right. If it was traveling at the speed of light, it would have only made it out to 14 gigalight years. So, and as a matter of fact, that's the present value, or actually this was the speed, 500 million years after the purported Big Bang, it was traveling 3 times the speed of light. In fact, if we go back to sooner than that time after the Big Bang, after what's called known as the initial singularity, the speed of matter in recession is nearly infinite. So the question, my point is that the only difference between the entire universe and the galaxy is just size. So if galaxies can travel faster than the speed of light, so can stars within the galaxies. Right. There's right. So in brief, star displacement is not, according to general relativity, is not a, not an issue. And then the next question is, does time dilation solve the problem? I claim no, because if we're going to be presentist, it says there's an actual now. The actual now that we're in is 7,000 to, you know, whatever years. The creation is, creation is 7,000 years ago. We have to agree that everything in the universe is 7,000 years from the initial creation, that we're all in the same now. I guess it's called year, right? So we have to agree that the universe as a whole has an exact single age. Okay. So time dilation is a distinction between the age of an object. So for example, you know, in science fiction, for example, Interstellar, where you go off and you're still young and your daughter's about on her deathbed, right? That's an issue of age. I mean, they were both in the same present. They were always in the same present. It's just that motion affects the rate at which you age.
It's a good example.
Right. Yeah. So the notion of a single age of the universe also comports with general relativity, since all clocks under influence of gravity alone tick at the same rate from the moment of creation. That's why they say the universe is 13.8, you know, a billion years old. Everything in the universe is 13.8 billion years old, right?
So, yeah.
That's so a good, I provide right. the so link to a
distinction between time and age.
Right. So, So clocks, physical clocks can run slow due to time dilation, right? Anyway, so I address this in another esoteric paper that I published in Answers Research Journal for those that have the savvy to be able to digest it, or for aspiring young Earth creationists that want to go into cosmology. Hopefully they can, if they don't understand it, can read that and digest what they can understand and encourage them to go into a advanced degree in cosmology.
Well, that's a great point and a great place to end it. We need more, right? We need
Correct.
More Phil Dennis's to come up and really think through some of these issues. I mean, especially your command over the mathematics and the physics of everything is just really incredible. So the more people that can really think with a critical mind toward the sort of solutions that we're developing for some of these problems, and as we develop the creation model more, I think that's just going to matter more and more and more. So yeah, if you're out there listening to this, or you have kids that are really interested in science, encourage them to actually go into some of these fields and to make a difference. Well, we're going to go ahead and wrap it up here. I'm not sure exactly what we're going to go into next time, whether we're going to talk a little more general about general relativity versus special relativity, and maybe get into some of the presentism versus eternalist stuff, or if we're going to dive into Phil's model. I'm not sure exactly which direction we're going next, but I'm sure it will be a joy whenever we get there. So Phil, thanks for your time again. We really appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you, Steve. I enjoyed the talks also, and I hope I adequately described the concepts and made certain points clearer, at least. I do agree there's a whole can of worms of issues. I think I mentioned this before, involved in this notion of ASC. It's the coreness, the conventionality, synchronizing clocks, simultaneity, presentism, eternalism. And hopefully the goal is to get those all untangled, and so that your viewers can suddenly start seeing the big picture and see how they're all related and how you have to converge on one given consistent theological, philosophical, and mathematical scientific point of view.
Amen. Yes, that's the goal, to be eminently consistent in everything that we do as Christians and as creationists. All right. Thanks again for your time, Phil, and we'll see you next time.
Okay, sounds good. Thanks, Steve.